I'd like to go ahead and be turning in your Bibles to 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy 1. Today is set aside in our country as a day to honor mothers. And while I'm certain that mothers enjoy the flowers and the cards and the gifts and the words of thanks, I hope nobody needs to be reminded to honor their mother. I hope we see the value in the work and the life that a mother lives, that we would do that anyway without having to have a day on the calendar to remind us of it. Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 2 reminds us that mothers are worthy of honor. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you, and you may live long on the earth. They are certainly worthy of honor. They're worthy of affection, too. You remember in 1 Kings 19, Elisha is plowing with oxen. He's there in the field. He has 12 oxen. And the prophet Elijah comes to him, and he takes his mantle and he throws it on his shoulder. And Elisha knows what that means. It knows that he is to follow him. And he says to him, "Please let me kiss my mother and father before I follow you." You know, when you think of that, he knows that he's going to leave. He knows that he's going to follow Elijah. But he knows there's something he needs to do. He needs to show affection for his parents. You know, young people, especially young men, sometimes may hesitate in showing affection for their mothers. You know, it's not very macho. Sometimes may not seem that way. But let's realize what we just saw here. This is Elisha. Let's remind ourselves of some things that Elisha did. You remember when there were some youths that came up and started mocking Elisha, and he laid a curse that called 2 she-bears out of the woods that mauled 42 of them? That's this guy. Not a wimp. This is the same guy who stood up when Naaman came to him, a Syrian general, and is just furious that Elisha won't come out and talk to him face to face. Elisha just takes, he's not intimidated by him in the least. That's Elisha. So this is a manly man. And yet we see him before he goes with Elijah. "Let me go back and kiss my mother. Let me go back and kiss my father. Let me show them the affection that is due to him." So tough man who still understands the importance of showing that affection there. This honor and affection are especially due to godly mothers. When we talk about godly mothers, what we mean are those who have dedicated their lives to serving the Lord. I have a few ways up here that we'll just mention. Godly mothers stand for the truth of the Scriptures, even when nobody else will. They will teach truth. They will do what is right. They will support God's way because they are God's women every time. That's what godly women do. They do it when it's not popular. They do it when it makes people mad at them. They do it because it's right. That's what godly women do. Godly mothers. They instruct children in the ways of the Lord. Can you imagine what shape the church would be in if there weren't godly mothers teaching children how to be godly? Certainly fathers have their place. I'm not taking anything away from that. But there is something special about mothers and the connection with their children and the ability they have to influence them, and in this case, influence them for good, influencing them to serve the Lord. So reading Paul's letter to Titus, they also instruct other women on how to act godly. It's an incredible example. You see, the older women are to show the younger women how to be godly, show them what they are to do, the things that they are to do in serving the Lord. And then don't leave this one out. I'd be in trouble without my wife. They support and strengthen godly men so we can be better. So we can be what we're supposed to be. We can serve in the role that we're supposed to serve in. Extremely important. The powerful influence that we see, it shouldn't be underestimated. I've got you there in 2 Timothy 1. Let's go back and look at the effect of this godly influence on the life of Timothy. 2 Timothy 1, verses 3 through 5. Let's look at those three. Paul's writing to Timothy. He says, "I thank God, whom I serve with a pure conscience, as my forefathers did. Without ceasing, I remember you in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see you, being mindful of your tears, that I may be filled with joy when I call to remembrance that genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also." Immediately you see the influence. And this one's interesting because he didn't just have one generation of godly woman influencing him. His grandmother was as well. So you see the impact that that has on Timothy. Turn over a page or so, and it actually gives us some more details there. Look in 2 Timothy 3, verses 14 and 15. How did they raise him? What did they teach him? How did they do this? 2 Timothy 3, verse 14. "But you must continue in the things which you have learned and been assured of, knowing from whom you have learned them, and that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus." Who do you think taught him? Well, just honestly, who do you think taught him these Scriptures and exposed him to this truth from a young age, from childhood? You've known the Scriptures. Who do you think did that? Lois and Eunice did that. It's very simple to see the effect that that had on Timothy. And certainly Timothy serving the Lord, teaching truth. Paul very confident in his ability to do that. Now, the influence of our actual literal mothers is powerful. We talked about this a little bit. We hinted at it somewhat in class this morning. As a member of the church, it's different though. You don't just have the influence of your literal, physical mother in the church. You have the influence of all kinds of mothers in the faith. Tons of mothers. You remember the time when Jesus is standing there and his mother and his brothers come in and someone tells him and he stretches his hand out. It's in Matthew 12. And he says, "Behold, here are my mother and brothers." And he's talking to those who believe him, brethren, those who are faithful. He goes on later in Matthew 19, and he mentions that those who leave family for his sake will receive family a hundredfold. That's Matthew 19, verse 29. Among Christians, there is a special fellowship like nothing else in this world. It is a family. And you end up having so many spiritual mothers, mothers in the faith that influence you over the years. Turn to Romans 16. This is a verse that until this week, I have never given a second thought. Never paid any attention to it. Romans 16, verse 13. This is that section. It's actually at the end of the letter to the Romans where Paul is greeting various saints. And to my shame, there have been times where I've read through that faster. Like, okay, we got all the good stuff in the book of Romans. Now here's the greetings. Let's read them. Okay, here we go. All right, that's great. Yeah, he loves them. Okay, and then you move on. Well, what's next? Let's go to 1 Corinthians. What a shame. Because who preserved this? The Holy Spirit did. Do you think there might be some lessons we can learn from it? Of course there are. And here's one that I've never thought about before. Romans 16, verse 13. We're talking about the influence of spiritual mothers. It was true for Paul the Apostle as well. As he's going through his greetings, he says, verse 13, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother and mine." Some of the newer versions say, "and his mother who has been a mother to me as well." I think the English Standard Version says it that way. This woman is not Paul's literal mother. And yet he says, "Greet her, who is my mother as well." She has treated Paul as if he were her own son. And we're not told exactly how. We're not told what she's done for him. But you know it was good, because this is the same thing that Christian women have been doing ever since the first century. They have been treating those with good, treating young men like their sons. Personally speaking, since I obeyed the gospel, I have so many mothers in the faith, I can't even list them. It is just incredible, because some of those women didn't even have physical sons, and yet they still treated me like one, because that's what godly women do. That's the way they act. There are women in this building who didn't know me 4 years ago, and you treat me like I'm your son. And it's not lost on me. It wasn't lost on Paul either. We should be thankful for that. What an incredible bond. What an incredible blessing it is. That's what godly mothers do. And we ought to thank God for it. Now that's our introduction. Let's change gears for a second. Let's talk about Hannah. Let's talk about one godly woman and godly mother in particular. Turn to 1 Samuel 1 and mark your places there. We'll focus the rest of our study in 1 Samuel 1. Hannah is faithful. She is a woman who loves the Lord. Certainly, she's a woman who's going to love Samuel. There are a lot of lessons that I think we can learn from her. Let's just get right into it. The first lesson we learn is that godly women have problems too. I think there are some in this world who believe that, you know, godly women just have it easy. God puts a bubble around them and just everything's fine. Usually it's the exact opposite, right? Because when you're striving to be godly, what does Satan do? He just pours it on. He puts on more and more pressure to try and break that. Because he knows that godly women, it's not just them. They influence. They have this huge sphere of influence. And if he can bring her down, what else can he do? He can wreck the lives of countless other people. He knows that. That's why he causes so many troubles. Let's read verses 1 through 7. Hannah had troubles as well. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim, in the mountains of Ephraim. His name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice the Lord of hosts to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priest of the Lord, were there. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. And a rival also provoked her severely to make her miserable, because the Lord had closed her womb. So it was year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, that she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. And then at verse 7, the she there, Peninnah provoked Hannah. She just tormented her. So we see two problems that this godly woman has. She can't have children. Verse 5 tells us that. This is always a difficult thing. But in a Jewish society that was very dependent on genealogy, it is an extremely big deal. This is a huge issue. A huge blow for her. On top, as if that's not bad enough, on top of it, verses 6 and 7, she's got this other rival who is rubbing it in her face every chance she gets. Because Peninnah apparently has no trouble having children. She has sons and daughters, and she just shoves it in Hannah's face all the time, torments her and mocks her. So what does Hannah do? Does she blame the Lord for her problems and curse Him for treating her? How dare you put me through this misery? She doesn't do that. She's a godly woman. In spite of everything going on, look at verse 7. She went up year by year to the house of the Lord because God was still God. Regardless of what her problems were, regardless of the situation she was in, God was still God. And He was worthy of her worship. And so she gave it to Him. Great example for us. It reminds me of Elizabeth in the New Testament. We studied her recently. She also was unable to have children. And yet she's called in Luke 1, righteous before the Lord, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. She didn't have what she wanted. She still served the Lord as best she could. So similar example there with Elizabeth. Now just when we look at this, makes me think, do we only worship God when things go our way? Because that's not the way Hannah was. Even when things didn't go her way, she served Him, she worshiped Him. If we only worship Him when everything's going well, that's not real faith. That's just using God as means to an end. Hannah didn't do that. She didn't let her problems get in the way of serving her God. Another example we see in her. Godly women seek out the Lord, and they seek His will specifically. Look at verse 10. All of these troubles have just piled up on her. She's overwhelmed. Where does she go? Verse 10. And she was in bitterness of soul, and she prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. She went to the Lord. She went to the one she knew who could help her through the situation. She doesn't take matters into her own hands. And we've seen that happen in the past. Abraham and Sarah, right? When they were run into the same issue, they decide to do it their way. They get the maidservant Hagar involved, and a mess ensues. They didn't wait around for God. They tried to do things their own way. She doesn't. She goes before the Lord and just falls down and just weeps and lays it at His feet. Notice how she prays in verse 11. Then she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will. Let's read the whole thing and then we'll come back and focus on that. If you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. I think when we read that, we see the vow, we see the promise that she's making. But notice how she words it. If you will. If it is your will, Lord, then I will do these things. It's extremely important because this affects us. Our prayers must be like that. They must be according to His will. Mark your places there. Go to 1 John 5. First John chapter 5. If we want our prayers to be answered, we have to pray according to His will, the same way as Hannah did. Verse 14. Now this is the confidence that we have in Him, that if we ask anything according to His will, He hears us. And if we know that He hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we have asked of Him. When we ask according to His will, Brother Holly talked about this. You pray according to God's will. You want what God's will is, you'll get it. Because it's His will. And that's something we need to remember, to take ourselves out of it. For this to happen, John also mentions, this is in John 15, book of John 15, verse 7. He puts a condition on this. We have to be faithful to the Lord. There is no reason to think, if you and I are living unfaithfully, when we go to God in prayer, that He's going to hear that prayer. There is no reason to think that. John 15, verse 7, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire and it shall be done for you. Well, what's the flip side? If you don't abide in me, if you're not abiding in my word and my words aren't abiding in you, don't expect it. He expects faithfulness as He hears those prayers. Turn to James 4. God has no time for selfish prayers. He has no patience for self-serving prayers. And that doesn't mean we can't pray for things that we need, but prayers that have no interest in His will and just want to serve the individual for their own base needs. James 4, verse 3, you ask and you do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. You're wasting your time, James says. So it is a humble approach in His will, asking those things. He knows exactly what He needs, what we need. It may not be what I think I need. It may be different from what I think, but He knows. Hannah understood this, and she prayed according to God's will. Another example that we see in her, one that I dearly love. Godly women do not play around with God. There are women in here in Bible classes who have said it that way. You don't play around with God. You don't mess with Him and just use Him and think you're going to get away with something. Hannah understood. She had made a promise, right? Let's go back to 1 Samuel 1. Verse 20, it wasn't long. Came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son, called his name Samuel, saying, because I've asked for him from the Lord. She had gone before the Lord. She had humbled herself. And if you remember the middle section of chapter 1 there, she goes before the house of the Lord and she's praying. Her lips are moving, but no words are coming out. And Eli is sitting there and he thinks, this woman is drunk. She came up to the house of the Lord. Is she out of her mind? And he starts berating her for it. And she says, no, your servant is not drunk. I am praying to the Lord. I'm pouring my heart out to the Lord. And he's like, oh, well, may it be as you said. Whatever you pray for, may God bless it. verse 20, it happens. We see it start coming to pass. But if you remember, back in verse 11, she made a promise with it. If you give me this male child, I will give him over to the service of the Lord all the days of his life. Verse 20, God answers. He gives her a son, Samuel. She had made a promise, and she fully intended to keep it. Look at 21. Now the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah did not go up, because she said to her husband, "Not until the child is weaned. Then I will take him, that he may appear before the Lord and remain there forever." So Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word." I appreciate him here too, because I take that to mean that Elkanah said, "Remember what you promised. You can keep him here until you wean him, but when he's weaned, you promised." So it tells me a lot about his character as well. The end of verse 23. Then the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. Verse 24. When she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bulls, one ephah of flour, one skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And the child was young. They slaughtered a bull and brought the child to Eli. And she said, "Oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to the Lord." She's speaking to Eli. "For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition which I asked of him. Therefore I have also lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord." So they worship the Lord there. You know, it is easy to say, you know, in her case, when you don't have a child, "Lord, I'll give him to you. I'll give him over to you completely." And then you're holding the baby that you've wanted for all this time. And remember what you promised. You would give him over to the service of the Lord. And I think what we're going to see, if you actually turn over a page, giving him over to the service of the Lord, she saw him once a year. 1 Samuel 2, verse 18. "Samuel ministered before the Lord, even as a child, wearing a linen ephod. Moreover, his mother used to make a little robe and bring it to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice." That sounds to me like she saw him once a year during the sacrifice. The rest of the time, he was there with Eli. He was doing the work around which would have been the tabernacle at that time. She prayed and prayed and prayed for this child. God answers it. How hard must this have been for her to see this baby once a year, and this child once a year? But she had promised God she would do it, and so she did. Imagine the impact this has on Samuel. It is obvious. Isn't it obvious that his mother loves him? I mean, the things that she does for him, the prayer that she offered. But what lesson does this teach him? Mama loves me, but she loves God more. God is most important to her. She loved and respected the Lord. And God didn't leave her hanging, because look at verse 21. The Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. And then Samuel continued to grow before the Lord. So God didn't just throw her off after she had offered her son into his service. He took care of her. Ask all of that to ask the question. You know, when Hannah made a promise, she kept it. Do we keep our promises? Especially the promises that we make to the Lord. Because we made some, right? Everyone in here who's married has made some promises before the Lord. Husbands, we have promised to love our wives as Christ loved the church. Am I doing that? Wives, you have promised before the Lord to love and honor and respect your husband, submitting to his authority as the leader of your household. Do you do that? Because we made those vows, those promises, to the Lord. Made another promise too. Turn to Hebrews 9. Mark, keep your places there in 1 Samuel if you'd like. But Hebrews 9. When you and I obeyed the gospel, we made a vow. We made a promise to serve the Lord faithfully. Hebrews 9. Verse 15. "For this reason, he," Jesus, "is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of eternal inheritance." He's promised us eternal life. We promise our allegiance to him when the blood is applied to us. When I confess the name of Christ, when I was baptized into him, I pledge my allegiance to serve him until death. Really, I pledge my allegiance to serve him eternally. It doesn't end with death. Am I doing that? because Hannah didn't forget her promise as soon as she got what she wanted. I'm afraid sometimes there are some brethren who had their sins washed away in baptism. They get what they wanted, and then they just go right back where they came from. Do we remember our promises the way Hannah did? One final point. Let's turn back to 1 Samuel. Godly women give the Lord the praise that He deserves. Verse 28 of chapter 1. After taking Samuel and leaving him in the service of the Lord. So she's not going to see him for a year. Notice the first thing she did. They worshiped the Lord there. She understands who God is. Then as chapter 2 opens, you got this beautiful prayer that shows, it just shows Hannah's heart. She opens up and we get to see her thought process. Verse 1 of chapter 2. Hannah prayed and said, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord, my strength. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation." God brings her joy. She shows us the joy that she has. She also understands who God is. Look at verse 2. "No one is holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you, nor is there any rock like our God." She praises Him for who He is. She just left her child here. She won't see Him for another 365 days. But God is still God, and she praises Him for His greatness. She knows that His power is supreme. Verse 6. "The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up again. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and lifts up. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the beggar from the ash heap to set them among princes and make them inherit the throne of glory." She knows His power. And she knows that the Lord is with His people at all times. Look at the first part of verse 9. "He will guard the feet of His saints." What a great confession that she makes. Do we give the Lord praise like this? When He answers our prayers, do we thank Him like this by honoring Him? Because He didn't have to. He is in no way obligated to answer my prayers. There's nothing I've done that earned me the right to come before His throne. He did it because He chose to. Do I thank Him? And do I glorify Him while understanding that? And here's the other one. Do we honor Him like this even if He doesn't answer our prayers the way we want them answered? That one's hard. He's still worthy. He's still glorious. He is still almighty. Do I honor Him even if He doesn't give me what I want? That's a heart of faith and the heart of someone who truly loves Him. Godly women and men understand this and glorify the Lord. Now, many lessons that we can learn from her, many more. Let's end with this lesson. God will guard the feet of His saints. That's the first part of verse 9. The second part. "But the wicked will be silent in darkness." Look at verse 10. It tells us about the enemies of God. "The adversaries of the Lord will be broken into pieces. From heaven He will thunder against them. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth." Which one am I? Am I one of His saints whose feet God guards? Or am I one of His enemies who will be broken before the power of the Almighty? Which one describes me? Let me get your songbooks out. The only way to go from being an enemy to a friend is through the blood of Christ. There is no other way. There's no work that I can do to earn it. The blood of His Son has to make me clean. We come in contact with that blood by confessing that Christ is the Son of God, having believed that, repenting of our sins, and being baptized for the remission of sins, the washing away of those sins. He adds us to His church. He makes us His people. Have I done that this morning?